Well, good evening. Like I said last week, I've kind of had a cold. Kind of sounds a little hoarse when I'm talking, so that's my excuse for this week for sounding funny. I don't normally have an excuse, but this week I do. So, but let's turn to Daniel chapter 8. While we're turning there, this hoarseness is from an actual cold. It's not from yelling at the Eagles today or yelling for them. I may or may not have yelled about the first play of the game when they got an interception, and Ruth said, "You have to preach tonight. You can't say anything the rest of the game." So she enjoyed it because it was a quiet game that I was watching. But Daniel chapter 8, and as we've gone through Revelation, we've reached Revelation chapter 13, where John has visions, one vision of a couple, as he describes them, beasts. A beast from the sea and that beast from the earth. And it really is a difficult passage to understand, difficult passage to interpret. There's a lot of symbols. There's a lot of pictures there. There's a lot of symbols and pictures in chapter 12. But those pictures are interpreted a little bit more. Chapter 13 is kind of difficult to understand. So what I want to do tonight is go to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel 8, where Daniel has a vision that's somewhat similar. Some of the things that he sees here are very similar to Revelation 13. So they're similar. And then, but here, the advantage, two of them. One is it's explained to us. The vision, he sees the vision, but then it's explained so we can see how God explains it, how God interprets it to him, but then it's also one that has occurred in the past. And so we can actually look back and say, well, how, when there's a vision like this, what does the actual fulfillment look like? How is it fulfilled? And so we can look at it. So we'll look here in Daniel 8, and then hopefully next week as we get to chapter 13, it'll be a little bit easier. We can apply some of the things that we see tonight in how we understand Revelation 13. But as we look in Daniel 8 here, we're reminded of a couple things. Reminded that a fulfilled prophecy, as this chapter has been fulfilled, gives us insight into how to interpret prophecy. But it also reminds us of the limits of our understanding. We can learn a little more how to study Revelation 13, and we should study it. We should learn from it. But there's also limits to how much we can understand. And this chapter shows us that. But this chapter also shows us God fulfilling his word. It really is a remarkable prophecy here that scholars looking back at it, those that are skeptical of God's word, they look at what Daniel 8 says, and then they look at history, and they say, they deny that God can prophesy. They deny the inerrancy of the Bible, and they say, well, it must have been written after the fact. It's so accurate that they can't deny and say, oh, no, that doesn't really fulfill it. They simply deny and say, oh, well, Daniel couldn't have been written as early as it was. It must have been written after these events, that some of which take place about 400 years after Daniel. So it does show us God fulfilling his word. And in that, we're reminded, ultimately, we trust God. Even as we talk about from Colossians 1, we do need endurance. We do need patience. We do go through difficult times. Well, in the end, who are we trusting? What are we trusting in the events of our lives, but also even in the big picture, the events of the end of the world? Are we trusting our perfect understanding and interpretation of Revelation, or are we trusting in God? Because there are pictures, there are symbols that are difficult to understand, but what is clear is God is victorious. God does have the victory. God is the one who protects his people and who brings the victory. And so he is the one we should turn to. He is the one that we should look to because he does give the victory. So we're reminded as we see this that we can trust the God who fulfills his word and his promises. But here in Daniel 8, if we start by looking at Daniel's vision. Daniel has a vision here at the beginning of the chapter. And he has this vision while the Babylonians were still in power. Daniel 8, verses 1 and 2. Says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel. which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. So Daniel had been exiled when he was very young. We think of Nebuchadnezzar coming in 586, destroying Jerusalem, destroying the temple. Well, the Babylonians had come in a couple times before that. And they had taken some of the Jews away even before that. And Daniel had been exiled in one of those previous attacks, spent much of his life in Babylon under Babylonian rule. But then the Medes and the Persians came in, conquer Babylon. And so the end of Daniel's life, he's under that Persian Empire. Well, here it's chapter 8, but he has this vision while Babylon is still in control. If you look at Daniel, chapters 1 through 6 are narrative. They're different events. They're things happening going through the life of Daniel. Then chapter 7 through 12 are prophecy. Visions like this that Daniel has, actual prophecy, but those prophecies don't all come after the events of chapter 6. It's not all chronological. These prophecies are scattered throughout his life. So here, it's said that it's during the third year of King Belshazzar. Where else do we see King Belshazzar? Someone that's under 18. Where do we see King Belshazzar in Daniel? What do we know about him? Maybe we should go to somebody over 18. Okay, so for anybody, do you remember who King Belshazzar is? Where else do we see him in Daniel? Yeah, in Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar is throwing that party and they see the handwriting on the wall where God announces and God says at that point as well, your kingdom's taken away. It's given to the Medes and the Persians. Well, Daniel has this vision back before that, while Babylon's still in control, while Belshazzar is still king. But he says that he's in Susa, the citadel. Susa was actually the capital of Persia. If you look in the book of Esther, many of the events of Esther happen in that city of Susa. And Daniel was a diplomat, basically, for much of his life in Babylon. Perhaps he actually was in Susa already, or perhaps it's part of the vision that he has. But either way, perhaps he's already literally there, just in the vision that he's placed there. But this vision takes place in that Persian city of Susa. So in Daniel's vision, he saw a very powerful ram. It says in verses 3 and 4, I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high. But one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there is no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. So Daniel sees this ram charging in three directions. It charges northward, westward, and southward. And at that point, no animal can stand before it. No one can stop it. But then he sees a goat come and attack the ram. Just kind of reading through, seeing what the vision actually is. And then we'll come back second half of the chapter where it's very explained and we can see how it's fulfilled. But in verses 5 through 8, it says, as I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. Comes from the opposite direction, coming from the west without touching the ground, seems to imply it's coming very quickly. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes, one very prominent horn, not in the normal place. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him with his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. There was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. The goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Interesting picture. A goat comes and defeats the ram. It has one horn, but then the horn gets broken and four horns grow up in place of it. Then Daniel saw a powerful new horn come up from among those four horns. So one great one is broken off, four grow up, but then one more comes. Verse 9, out of one of them, so out of one of those horns, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, certain direction, toward the south, toward the east, and also toward the glorious land. Now we'll get to more of the interpretation, but what do you think the glorious land is? It'd be Israel. It's a description for Israel. So this horn that comes up goes towards the south, towards the east, and also towards Israel. As it tells us more about him in verses 11 through 14. Says, it became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, for how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, similar but not the same as a phrase that we've seen before of abomination of desolation, but here it's called a transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot. And he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. So that's kind of the summary of Daniel's vision. And in this part of the vision, he sees this horn come, and there's those symbols, a ram, a goat, horns growing up, one horn replacing other horns, things like that. But then there's also some direct statements of what happens. Talks about sacrifice being cut off. Talks about truth being thrown to the ground. It gives a specific time frame. It says these things are going to go on for 2,300 days. Okay. Now, as we'll see, and as we see in the fulfillment, this horn represents a person, but a person in the past, person in history that we'll look at. But some of the things that he does here, and looking back in history at some of the things he does, is very similar to what the Antichrist does. What Scripture in 2 Thessalonians, even in Revelation, predicts of the Antichrist, this person is very similar. And that's another reason we came to Daniel 8, because the similarities here. But he's very similar to the Antichrist. But before we see the explanation, because the explanation also shows it, there's something here that shows that it's not the Antichrist. Okay? He does a lot of similar things. He cuts off sacrifices. He oppresses the people, the host, the Jewish people. But there is something that's said here that points to it not being the Antichrist in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. What is that? What is that clue that it's talking about something else? What time frame have we seen in Daniel 9 with the Antichrist cutting off sacrifices, and in Revelation, what's the time frame that's repeatedly given? Yeah, 3.5 years. Sometimes said a time, times, and half a time, a year, 2 years, and a half a year. Sometimes said 42 months. Sometimes 1,260 days. We keep seeing that time description given. Here, a different time frame is given. It's talking about someone else, a different time point in history, but it's very similar types of things that he does. But this guy will last for 2,300 days. So there's Daniel's vision, but God gave Daniel a very clear explanation of the vision of the ram and the goat, okay? The ram with two uneven horns represents the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Well, how do we get there? Well, God came right out and said it in verse 20. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. Okay, the two horns are the kings of Media and Persia, a united empire, but one that actually came from two separate people groups. The Medes and the Persians, there's the people group of the Medes and the people group of the Persians. Originally, the Medes were actually more powerful. They were more powerful. They unite with the Persians to conquer Babylon. Gradually, the Persians grow. The Persians become superior. They become more powerful. Pictured by the one ram, or the one horn, coming up later, but then becoming higher. Persians kind of started as a lesser people group, but they become dominant. And that's why sometimes it's called the Median Persian Empire. Very often it's just called the Persian Empire. One that, when it comes, when it conquers Babylon in Daniel 5, after that, up to that point in history, it is the most powerful empire in the world. And then remember, there's directions. It said they had gone, it traveled west and south and north. That's largely the direction of that empire. They went a little bit east. They did expand from Persia towards the east a little bit, even though they didn't hold the land as well. But they went north to the Caspian Sea, up getting close to Russia. They went west past Babylon. They actually extended past Israel and over pretty close to Greece. And then they went south into Africa. They went into Egypt. They went into Ethiopia. And so, just by way of observation, here drawing it to Revelation 13, how does this help us understand Revelation 13? Well, there's details given. There's animals, there's a goat, there's a ram that have horns. The horns are described in a particular way that has a meaning. It does have a reference point. The horns represent the Medes and the Persians. Those details that are given are significant. But if it wasn't explained to Daniel, would he understand right away what it would look like? Probably not. Okay. When we come to Revelation 13, we see some, we see vision that John has. We see some of the details. Not all the details are immediately clear. We can look at it, we can study it. Not all of it is quite so clear. And that's why I say we have to recognize the limits of our understanding. But this this first ram, the Medes and Persians, they do come. They do conquer Babylon. This part is actually fulfilled in Daniel's lifetime. But then after Daniel dies, he doesn't live long enough to see this, but the goat represents the kingdom of Greece. Well, how do you know that? Verses 21 and 22. And the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose. Four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. If you know the history of the Greeks, who was the first king of their actual empire? They had kings before within their own land, but as their empire really grew, who was that first king? Yeah, it's Alexander. Alexander the Great. Statues, pictures that are supposed to live, look like him. But Alexander the Great, remember it said that that the goat is going east, which Greece, to have to attack Persia, they're going to have to go east, and says he's not even touching the ground. Picture of him coming very fast. Alexander the Great, 20 years old when he becomes king, and within just a couple years, he conquers Persia. He defeats that massive empire, just as God predicted, the goat coming in, defeating the ram. Alexander the Great conquers the Persians, goes even further east, goes all the way to India. And some legends say that once he got there, he sat down and cried because there's no more world to conquer. He was so focused on conquering as much territory as he could. But then do you know how old Alexander was when he died? 23. He was older than 23. He was 32. Okay, he becomes king at 20, conquers, sets up to that point, the biggest empire the world has seen. Persia was the biggest. He makes a bigger empire. 12 years later, he dies when he's 32. Just like God predicted, God said, when they are very strong, that great horn will be broken. And when he died, he did not appoint a successor. He did not appoint someone as he was getting close to death. He didn't appoint someone to replace him. Some say that when they asked him, he just said, well, let him fight it out and see who wins. And so his kingdom is divided between four of his generals. Just as God said it, well, four horns grow up in place, four kingdoms will grow up, but they won't be as strong as that first one. It's exactly what happens. Four kingdoms grow up, but none are ever as strong as Alexander's original empire. But then, thinking of Israel, thinking of some of these prophecies, the two most important ones, down in Egypt, because Greece controlled that area of Egypt, was a Ptolemaic kingdom, and then the Seleucid kingdom was centered a little bit north of Israel. It was centered in Syria, and so Syria to north of Israel, Egypt to the south, southwest, Israel's right in between. So if those nations fight back and forth, as they often did, Israel is going to be right in the middle of it. And so that's what's going to be significant when we come to that last horn. But thinking about Alexander, Alexander's empire grew. As his empire grew, he desired to spread Greek culture and Greek religion. Phrase for it, the phrase Hellenization. What's it mean? It means the spreading of Greek culture. And it seems Alexander really thought, well, we are superior. We have the best culture. We want to spread it. And he did it, in a sense, somewhat graciously. He didn't come out and completely force people to turn to Greek culture, but he did strongly encourage them to do it. He didn't completely shut down their way of life, didn't completely shut down their local religions, but he did push Greek culture. He did push the Greek religion. And so if you think about it, this is happening in the 300s BC. The Jews had already been exiled for unfaithfulness. That's why God let Assyria conquer Israel. That's why God let Babylon conquer Judah. They've been unfaithful. They've turned to the pagan culture, the pagan nations, the pagan beliefs and religions from around them. They turned away from the Lord. Now Alexander is coming along and in control of Israel, amongst other places, he's saying, follow our culture, follow our religion. And so it really was a temptation for the Jews. And the Jews in this time had divided. There were some who very strongly said, no, that's what got us exiled in the first place. We have to stay away from that. There are others who said, well, life's going to be a lot easier. We'll be a lot richer. We'll be more powerful if we do follow it. And so they did turn to that Greek way of thinking. Festus, when we come to the New Testament, there were many Jews, even in this time, between the Old and New Testament that followed Hellenism. The Sadducees eventually came from that group. They're the group that was willing to work with other governments around them and somewhat accept their culture. That's why they're more politically powerful in the New Testament. Pharisees came from the conservatives, those that wanted to conserve Judaism. The Pharisees eventually came out of that group. Also in Acts 6, the origin of deacons. What does Hellenization have to do with Acts 6? What was the conflict in Acts chapter 6? Yeah, the Greek widows were not being cared for. Why are they called Greek? They're Hellenized people. Many of them would have, especially that early in the church, they were from a Jewish background. They were Hellenized Jews. They were Jewish, but they'd accepted Greek culture. And the Jews that had held on to Jewish culture treated them kind of as second-class citizens. There was a conflict there that went back to this division where some Jews stuck strongly with Judaism and some drifted into Hellenism. And really, that Hellenism, it was a great temptation. They were tempted to turn to pagan culture that very often went against God's word and to those pagan religions. Well, we see some explanation given. But during that time of Hellenization, the little horn destroyed much. There's the four horns that grow up and replace it, the four kingdoms. Alexander's kingdom is divided. Well, then it says one little horn comes out of one of the four, and he destroys a lot. Verses 9 down through 14, it describes some of what he does. But verses 23 to 25 says, at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, who are those transgressors? Some will take it as the Greeks. It's somewhat nearing the end of their power before the Romans come. But many actually take that as the Jews. Because of the Jews turning to pagan culture, because of them accepting Hellenism, again drifting away from the Lord, many interpret that as saying, well, the Lord again punishes them. He punishes them to draw them back just like when they were exiled. When the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. He will end up a powerful king, but he didn't earn it himself. And he shall cause fearful destruction, shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. He's going to attack those who do believe in God. The Jews who were still faithful, he's going to attack them. Again, much as we see the Antichrist doing. By his cunning, he shall make deceit prosper under his hand. He's going to be a very deceitful person. and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many. He's not going to give much warning, but at some point he's going to attack and destroy many. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. Prince of princes, ultimately God himself, he'll try to rise up and reject God, but this horn is going to be broken. This person's going to be defeated by no human hand. It's going to be clear that it's not another army coming in and defeating him. God's ultimately going to put him down. Well, who is this? What is predicted here by this little horn? Well, if you look back in history, coming out of one of the four kingdoms of the Greeks is a king named Antiochus IV. Sometimes said Antiochus, but Antiochus IV of the Seleucid kingdom. That kingdom that's based in Syria, that's a little north of Israel, there's this king named Antiochus IV. Well, he wasn't supposed to be king. Remember, the prophecy had said that he would become king, he would become powerful, but not by his own power. Well, Antiochus IV, he wasn't even in line to be king. He had an older brother, and when he was dead, his nephew was supposed to become king. But by lies, by bribery, by deceit, he actually got himself appointed as king. Romans are becoming more powerful. He used the Romans somewhat to help get himself appointed as king. Well, then in the 2nd century BC, he tried to defeat the Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt. From Syria, what direction is Egypt? It's south. Remember, it said that the little horn would become powerful to the south, to the east, and towards the blessed land, towards Israel. He goes first south towards Egypt. He tries to attack where the Greek kingdom had split. He tries to attack in Egypt, and at first he is successful. He's conquering the kingdom, and the Romans kind of step in and say, no, we don't want you to become this powerful. They were rising in power then. We don't want you to become this powerful. Just leave Egypt. Well, he's humiliated. He's angry about that. And on his way back home, he has to pass through Israel. And so what does he do? He's angry. He's humiliated. He's also short on money. He needs money to help pay for this war as he's been fighting. And so he goes into Israel, and he tries to, one, take much of the treasure of the temple, much of the treasure of the Jews. He tries to take much of their money, but he also very strongly tries to force Hellenism on them. Like I said, Alexander pushed it, but he was somewhat gracious. He would still let the Jews offer sacrifices. He would still let them have the temple. He would still let them have the law. Antiochus came in and said, no, if you try to follow the law, if you observe the feast days, if you observe the Sabbath, I'll have you killed. And he did. He had many killed. He, as the prophecy said, he would have truth thrown to the ground. He had their copies of the law burned. In 167 BC, he cut off the sacrifices. He said, no, you cannot come to the temple. You cannot worship God here. You cannot offer sacrifices to the Lord. Does anybody know from history what he did at the temple? He did something there so that the Jews wouldn't offer sacrifices. Do you remember what he did? Yeah, He killed a pig, which to the Jews, a pig was an unclean animal. They would never offer it for sacrifices. He killed a pig and offered it on the altar there. He also set up an altar to Zeus, one of the Greek gods. He set up an altar to Zeus in the temple and sacrifices a pig there. For the Jews, that makes it unclean. They can't offer sacrifices there. Does anybody know his other name? Called him Antiochus IV, because Antiochus is a common Greek name. He's the fourth king with that name. But what title does he take for himself? He takes the title Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. Do you know what Epiphanes means? It means a manifestation of the gods. He takes that title for himself saying, I am a manifestation of the gods. Not only do you need to worship Zeus, not only can you not follow Judaism, by the way, I'm a god myself. I represent them. I'm a god come in the flesh that you should worship me as well. Something that we see later on, especially in Revelation 2 and 3, the Roman emperor is taking for themselves as well. They claim to be gods. They call on the Jews to turn from the Lord and worship them. Well, God said these things would happen. God God pointing to the kingdoms, kingdom of the Medes and Persians, God pointing to the Greek kingdom being split into four. He points to this one becoming very powerful and very, very aggressive towards the Jews, much oppression that he's going to give them. But think about the Jews in that day, because they're seeing the fulfillment of this prophecy. They've seen the Medes and Persians rise. They've seen them fall. Looking back in history, it's over a couple hundred years. They didn't live that long. But they've seen these things have happened. The Greeks have risen. Alexander the Great dies. Kingdom split. Now Antiochus is coming. But they also have a promise there. They have a promise. He's going to be defeated. He's going to last for 2,300 days, but he's going to be defeated. And they need to decide if they're going to trust in what God has said or not. Well, this oppression of Antiochus led to the Maccabean revolt. The Maccabees were a Jewish family that lead this revolt against them, that really push back, fight against them, and they are successful. The temple was cleansed in December 164 BC, and the sacrifices were reinstituted. Do you know what Jewish holiday celebrates that? Hanukkah. Where they have that menorah, this time they have a menorah with 9 candlesticks. They light one and then use it to light a different candle each day for the 8 days of Hanukkah. Hanukkah means dedication. It's them rededicating the temple to be able to offer sacrifices there again. Now think about John chapter 10. John 10, verses 22 and 23. At that time, the feast of dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the colonnade of Solomon. What is the feast of dedication? It's Hanukkah. That's what Hanukkah means. It's wintertime. Hanukkah is in December, and Christ is at the temple. He's at the place where Antiochus proclaimed himself to be God and demanded worship, but offered, wrongly, obviously, and offered a pig as a sacrifice. Now Christ, at that feast of dedication, at Hanukkah, where the Jews are remembering their defeat of Antiochus with God's help, they're remembering that, Christ is now at the temple in John 10. And he makes those statements about eternal security, his sheep hearing his voice, knowing him, following him, and him holding them in his hand, they are secure. But then what else does he say? Verses 30 to 33. He says, I and the Father are one. Makes a claim about his deity. He claims to be God. And there's some skeptics that don't believe in the deity of Christ, and they'll say, well, that idea came up later, or maybe it's in the epistles, but Christ never claimed himself to be God. Well, he actually did right here, and he did in some other places as well. But he said, I and my Father are one. The Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, I've shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to stone me? The Jews answered him, it is not for a good work that we are going to stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God. They rightly recognized what he was saying. They realized he was saying he is God. But they didn't believe it. They rejected the truth. But think about where the Jews are at. They're celebrating Hanukkah when Antiochus had claimed to be God. In their minds, not that they're right, but in their minds, kind of like somebody at Independence Hall on the 4th of July standing up and saying, well, I'm your new king. Go ahead and pay me lots of taxes. To them, that's what Hanukkah is. Hanukkah is remembering the defeat of Antiochus. It's remembering them remembering that they have the freedom from that Greek religion. But they reject the true message of Christ. As Pastor Jeremy preached this morning, Christ has made clear who he is. His word makes clear who he is. They're choosing to reject it. They're choosing to refuse to see the truth. Christ's claim is accurate about who he is, but I think it's fascinating. He makes that claim in John 10 during that Feast of Hanukkah in remembrance of the cleansing of the temple. But as we think through these things, this prophecy of Daniel 8 is very similar to some of the prophecies about the Antichrist. And God preserved Israel through the difficult days of Antiochus IV. Okay, we see the vision, we see the explanation, the details point to specific things. We look back in history, God fulfills what he said. God did what he said that he would do. Even that 2,300 days. It doesn't actually start when Antiochus first cut off sacrifices. It started about 170 BC. Antiochus had had the high priest assassinated and replaced by a very Hellenistic high priest. And about 2,300 days later is when the temple is cleansed, when they reinstitute sacrifices. God fulfilled his word there, but Antiochus oppressed the believers in God. He cut off the sacrifices as they tried to follow God. He made it illegal, said, don't follow this religion, worship me. That's very similar to a lot of things the Antichrist does. 2 Thessalonians pointing to him demanding worship of himself. Daniel 9, we've seen it before, but verse 27, here it is speaking of the Antichrist. It says, he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, 7 years, for half the week, that's that 3.5 years, he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate till the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. Okay, Daniel 8's already happened. It's already been fulfilled. Daniel 9, this, that abomination that makes desolate. Abomination of desolation. Daniel 9, Daniel 11, Christ in the New Testament, we looked at it a couple weeks ago, Christ said, when you see these things happening, flee out of Judea to the mountains. He gave that warning to the Jewish people to flee away. And we see many of the Jews apparently during the tribulation at that point acknowledging God at this point, but still offering sacrifices. Seem they haven't yet turned to Christ. Seems that they haven't yet believed in him as Savior. But many scholars that look at say, well, some of these events, God protects them, God preserves many of these Jewish people, and eventually they do turn to Christ. They turn from following sacrifices. And perhaps it's because they see the Antichrist setting himself up, demanding worship. They reject that, finally do turn to Jesus as the Messiah. But one of the other reasons I looked at this, as we look at the Antichrist, we'll reference back to some of these things that Antiochus does, because the Antichrist does many similar things as well. But if we think for a minute tonight, how do these things help our interpretation of Revelation 13? We see a vision, we see it explained, we see a historical fulfillment, represents real nations, real people, we see some of what it actually looks like. Well, when we come to a chapter like Revelation 13, we can make tentative conclusions. We could say, well, the beast and the horns, they often represent kingdoms and kings. Reasonably, in Revelation 13, it probably represents something similar. We can make applications from the text where the text does say, well, here's how you apply it. We can make those applications. But you also need to remember our understanding is limited. Look at what Daniel says, chapter 8, verse 27. The end of this vision. He's had the vision. He's also heard the explanation. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. He wanted to understand it. He did study it. He worked at it. God gave him some explanation, but he still doesn't understand all of it. It does represent, he could tell you, well, it represents the Medes and Persians, represents the Greek kingdom. There's going to be four Greek kingdoms that come out of it. Sacrifices are going to get cut off. The oppression's going to last 2,300 days. He could tell you about that, but he couldn't tell you Alexander's name. He couldn't tell you Antiochus's name. He couldn't tell about Hellenism and the dangers and temptations that it brought. He couldn't tell you about the Maccabees. He couldn't name that family that God used. He can't tell you about Hanukkah. There's a limit to his understanding. See it in 1 Peter as well. 1 Peter 1, 10 to 12. Concerning this salvation, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that was to be yours searched and inquired carefully, inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. It was revealed to them that they were serving not themselves, but you, in the things that have now been announced to you through those who predicted the good news to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. What does Peter say about salvation? He said there are Old Testament prophets that received the prophecy, and they could see it. They saw, okay, there's sufferings of Christ. There is glory of Christ after the sufferings. Well, what does that look like? How is that going to happen? Those prophets wondered. They looked into it. They studied. And they could tell some things. They could tell the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. They could tell he was going to suffer from Isaiah 53, other passages like that. From Isaiah 7, they could point to the virgin birth. But they couldn't tell you about the taxing of Augustus that brought Mary and Joseph to Bethlehem. They couldn't tell you the names of the wise men. They couldn't tell you about the shepherds in the manger. There's a limit to their understanding. And really, that's the mindset we need to have as we come to a chapter like a passage like Revelation. There is a value in studying it. God's given us his word. It's part of his word. We should study it. We should seek to understand it. But there are limits to what we understand. Someone said that apart from Christ, there's actually more prophecy given to the Antichrist than anyone else in Scripture. There is a lot of prophecy, and there's value in studying that prophecy. And we could see coming Antichrist who cuts off sacrifices, Daniel 9. He demands worship, 2 Thessalonians 2, Revelation 13, as we get there. And he's much like Antiochus. Many of the things that are predicted that he'll do, we can look back and say, hey, that looks a lot like what Antiochus did. Very likely that the Antichrist will be much like Antiochus. But we don't know when he's going to come. We don't know when the Antichrist will come. We don't know his name. We don't know exactly what his mark is. There's things that we don't know as well. But we do know God's in control. Ultimately, we do know God's in control. He will be victorious. So we don't trust in our perfect understanding of future events, but we trust in God. And that's really the main point, and the main point of Revelation being the revelation of Christ. Christ is being revealed. Christ is being revealed as the victorious king. Thinking about chapter 12, the woman flees into the wilderness. God gives her the two wings of an eagle to help her. Well, a lot of debate, a lot of people say, well, what are the two wings? What is going on there? Well, the main point isn't what the two wings are. The main point is God provides them. The main point isn't to say, well, look to America because America is represented by an eagle, or look to Zimbabwe because Zimbabwe is symbolized by an eagle. It must be them. Look to them for protection. No, the main point is look to God. Look to God for protection. He's ultimately the one providing the protection. He's ultimately the one who will be victorious. So when we take it and apply it in our own lives, difficult times do come. They do come into our own lives. We can't always see the end. We don't always know what's going to happen. Revelation 13, we don't know what everything's going to look like. In our own lives, even if we don't live that long, even in our own lives, we don't know what the end's going to look like. We don't know everything that's going to happen in the future. But God does. God does know. And we have promises like Romans 8 that even if we go through difficult things, God will use them for good. God does know. He is in control. He's promised to do what's best for us. And so as we go through those difficult times, sometimes God takes them away quickly. Sometimes we go through them for a long time. In the end, we need to be looking to him. We need to be focused on him. We need to be turning to him, trusting him as we go through those difficult times. So we can trust God who fulfills his word and his promises. We see him fulfill his promise here. Daniel 8 promises predictions about Media, about Persia, about Greece, about kings that are so accurate that skeptics look at it and say that cannot have been written before the events happened. We trust God's word. God says it did happen before, but that's the God that we follow, one who does fulfill his word, one who does fulfill his promises, and so we can trust in him. So I'll stop there for tonight. Next week, we'll probably get into chapter 13, looking at that beast from the sea that is the Antichrist in his kingdom. Just thought, if you want a head start on it, this week you can read Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, we'll look at that a little bit as well. Daniel 7, Revelation 13, very, very similar chapters, pointing to many of the same things. So if you want a head start of what we'll look at, Daniel 7 has a lot of it as well. But any questions, any comments?